This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're beginning a listening session. We'll listen to a talk with President Obama. What you commonly do with an interview like this is record it and then listen back to see what you've got. This interview is a wide-ranging discussion, as news articles commonly say. We talk about politics in the U.S. and Europe. We talk about Donald Trump. And we ask questions that grow out of an NPR documentary talking with voters. Our listening session includes two people who've listened to presidents for years. NPR's Mara Liasson and Scott Horsley are in our studios. Hi, guys.
Good to be Hello.
With you.
So let's all sit back, relax, pop a beverage. This begins on the way to the interview. So it's a lovely day, a little warm. We're walking down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. We're on our way up to the White House, which is the final stop in a more than 1,700-mile journey. We've been asking Americans how their lives have changed during the past 8 years, the 8 years of President Obama's administration. And now we're going to ask the president.
Hello, everybody.
We met him in the state dining room. The white ceiling is high, which allows space for the huge dark painting of Lincoln brooding over the fireplace. That setting is fitting because, as you'll hear, this is a president who often riffs on history while talking of today.
We all good?
Yes, sir.
Technical people?
Everybody's
sound? Everybody's happy with the sound?
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's
go. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. You've been told, I think, that we are doing a documentary. We went across a good part of the country to places where you'd given speeches over the years to just talk with people about how their lives have changed.
That and sounds great. I'm going to listen to this one.
That's great. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of our discussion
right
here, although we'll range a little bit farther. This caused me to go back and look at some of your speeches.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one in St. Charles, Missouri in 2010.
Yeah. And let's face it, people have lost faith in government. They had lost faith in government before I ran, and it's been getting worse.
Do the events of this year suggest that it's getting even worse?
A legitimate object of government. I'm not sure if it is getting even worse. I think that there has been a steady growth in people's cynicism about institutions generally, and government in particular.
And as the president knows, that frustration has shaped this year's presidential campaign.
And some of it is justified because we've got a Congress that's been dysfunctional now for quite some time and can't seem to organize itself to solve problems. You now have a Republican Congress. They control both chambers, and they can't even pass their own agenda, much less pass something that has bipartisan support. And at a time when there are a lot of big issues out there, people feel as if things aren't working the way they should. Having said that, not all of the cynicism is justified. So even without Congress cooperating, we've been able to make big progress on a whole range of issues.
If some of the cynicism is not justified, are you concerned that voters this year will go too far in overturning things?
You know, ultimately, I have confidence in our voters. You know, if you look at American history, there have been times where we've taken some tough turns, primarily fed by fear and disruptions and dislocations, but with a very substantial exception of the Civil War. Generally speaking, the democratic process muddled through, and we emerged better and stronger than we were before.
And the president expressed confidence that voters will not overturn the system. In other words, confidence that he will not, in January, be writing a letter to leave in his desk for President-elect Donald Trump. But not too much confidence, because the president has increasingly focused on his concerns about the media.
I've said this before, if you're watching Fox News, you have a different set of facts than if you're reading the New York Times editorial page. And that, I think, has led or increased the polarization. And that makes it harder for people to sort through who's telling the truth and how we actually get stuff done.
Let me ask, though, Mr. President, you've still got the biggest megaphone.
Yeah.
People can even see you on Fox News.
Right.
If you've been president for almost 7.5 years and people have still no faith in government, are you accountable for that?
Well, look, as a general proposition, I don't spend a lot of time looking at polls. But what's interesting is right now,
There's a poll you like to look at.
Well, right now, I think the majority of the American people think that I'm doing a good job. That does not necessarily give me a lot of comfort if I can't move this Congress forward. And the question then becomes, and I've heard some people in the Republican Party suggest that in some fashion I'm responsible for what's happened to them. And the rise of Trump and the dysfunction that you see in their party generally. What I would say is that I came into office wanting to work on a bipartisan basis, and if you've looked at my old speeches, you would see that. They made a determination that it was good politics to oppose everything that I did. The problem was is that by opposing everything I did, even things that previously they had been for, it pushed their party further and further to the right.
We're in the middle of a listening session, listening to President Obama with our political correspondents. Now, when we spoke, one polling average put Obama's approval rating above 50%, as he said. But he acknowledged the power of another statistic, one directly relevant to people's lives. The median wage for Americans has barely moved for decades. During our travels, we met numerous voters living that statistic, including Heather Gray of Wichita, Kansas.
Are you doing better or worse than 8 years ago?
Worse. People are always talking about how they shouldn't raise the minimum wage, but 16 years ago I got $10 an hour, and here I still get paid $10 an hour. It's a questionable thing.
What do you want to see in the next president?
Someone who actually cares about everybody in a totality thing, as opposed to just the rich.
Do you think Obama only cared about the rich?
No, I think that he was a good president, somewhat. I think he was soft on a lot of things.
As with a number of the people we met on the road, we paraphrased her concerns to the president so he could answer them.
The problem of stagnant wages, of course, did not start with your presidency,
yeah.
But it hasn't improved much.
Right.
Why not?
Well, we've got some long-term trends that we have to battle. And when I came into office, we were in the midst of the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. We have successfully dug ourselves out of that hole. And
the country has, but that, wages have not improved.
Understood. I'm going to answer your question.
Okay.
Yeah. Just giving a little context here.
Okay.
Right? So we had unemployment at 10%. It's now below 5. We had a housing market that had completely collapsed. It's now normalized.
And in our talk, the president offered numbers to quantify how he says the economy has changed. He said Americans have recovered trillions of dollars in wealth as the economy has improved.
But the long-term trends that had occurred before I took office and have continued is a combination of globalization and automation leading to more downward pressure on wages because you need fewer workers to make a certain amount of stuff. And entire job sectors being shrunk or eliminated. More and more people going into the service sector. And in the service sector, historically, wages have been lower. And that's all been compounded by some very specific policies, both at the federal and the state level, that's made it harder for workers to organize and get more leverage to get higher wages. This is why we fought for higher minimum wages. This is why we fought for making it easier to collectively bargain.
There is a writer for the Financial Times, Philip Stevens,
mm-hmm.
who wrote something interesting after Britain voted to leave the European Union last week.
Right.
He wrote in a column, globalization is not working, that it may make countries richer, but the majority of people are not benefiting. He was writing about Britain, but you mentioned globalization in the context of the United States.
Yeah.
Is he right? Globalization isn't working?
I think he's right that what you're seeing across the advanced economies is that when you have globalization and suddenly there's competition from everywhere, that empowers people who have a lot of skills, can use the internet, suddenly they have access to all the markets. And what that means is if you're very good at something, if you are LeBron James, or you are Seinfeld, or you are Steve Jobs, then suddenly you can leverage your skills in ways that you could never do before.
And if you're not LeBron James, you may be out of a job. In our documentary, we sat in a restaurant with Joe Garst, an engineer who once worked for Beechcraft, the aircraft maker in Kansas.
And when did you retire?
I retired 5 years ago.
Did you, this is a funny question, but people in manufacturing, you got to ask, did you retire when you wanted to retire?
Actually, I went at 62. They were going to lay off my two bottom guys, and so I retired to save their job, and it saved their job for a year anyway before they laid them off.
Manufacturing employment has recovered but remains well below its levels from before the recession, and the president says the service jobs that replaced factory jobs simply pay less.
And that is not going to be economically sustainable because it turns out that the economy works best when everybody has a stake in it and workers have money in their pockets and are spending it, and that's good for business. But it's also not politically sustainable because people start getting frustrated and they start getting resentful. And I think you see that somewhat in the Brexit vote. You see some of it in both the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign, people feeling as if we are potentially being left behind.
That's President Obama speaking June 27th at the White House. This is a listening session. We're listening to the president with our political correspondents, Mara Liasson and Scott Horsley. What strikes you?
Well, Steve, the president talked about a couple things he fought for to give workers more leverage in dividing up the economic pie, things like a higher minimum wage, easier collective bargaining, but he was unsuccessful in those two efforts. He did make some difference around the margin. The tax code's a little more progressive than it used to be. The new overtime rule will help millions of workers get slightly fatter paychecks. The best thing that's happened is that drop in the unemployment rate, which gives workers more leverage to command higher wages, but there's still a long way to go.
Mara Liasson.
Well, the president really understands, although he's frustrated to do much about it, what is the number one challenge for all Western democracies, which is we don't have enough growth, and what growth we have is not broadly shared.
Okay, that's Mara Liasson, Scott Horsley. We'll hear from them again on this listening session. And after a break, we'll hear one point in which the president says he agrees with Donald Trump. This is NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Shortly after the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union, Donald Trump stepped before TV cameras. He was in Scotland at the time, at a golf course he owned, and his press conference turned to the subject of his own campaign for president.
I really do see a parallel between what's happening in the United States and what's happening here. People want to see borders. They don't necessarily want people pouring into their country.
On the same day, Trump's campaign released a statement saying Americans, too, would have a chance to, quote, reject today's rule by the global elite. We mention this because President Obama talked of the global elite, too. He did it a few days later at the White House. It was in an NPR News interview, and this is a listening session. We're sitting with our political correspondents listening to parts of that interview. Let's play the section where Obama agrees, in part, with Donald Trump.
The issue is not that the world shrinking in globalization is inherently a bad thing. I actually think that over time, it can raise everybody's living standards and create a more peaceful world. But if you do it in a way that where the benefits of globalization are only for the elites who are flying around from capital to capital and looking at their investment portfolios on a laptop or a computer screen, and they're not worrying, they feel disengaged from their national economies and their national workers and their national communities, then you're going to see a reaction to it.
Donald Trump talked about global elites after the vote in Britain. Is Trump right, then, that there are big parallels between what motivated the British vote and what people are feeling and thinking about in the election this year in the United States?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that Mr. Trump embodies global elites and has taken full advantage of it his entire life. And so he's hardly a spokesperson for a legitimate spokesperson for a populist surge from working class people on either side of the Atlantic. I think that some of the concerns around immigration, some of the concerns around a loss of control or a loss of national identity. Those are similar. I think there is a xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment that's flashing up, not just in Great Britain, but throughout Europe, that has some parallels with what Mr. Trump has been trying to stir up here.
The president makes one more assertion, though, in this interview. He says the economy has improved more quickly in the United States than it has in Europe.
So overall, I think that the differences are greater than the similarities. But what is absolutely true is that the ability to tap into a fear that people may have about losing control to offer some sort of vague nostalgic feelings about how we'll make Britain great again, or we'll make America great again, and the subtext for that is somehow that a bunch of foreigners and funny-looking people are coming in here and changing the basic character of the nation. I think that some of that is out there, both in Europe and in the United States. And again, that's not unique to England. You've seen it in the Le Pen party in France. You see it in some of the far-right parties in other parts of Europe as well.
You mentioned people fearful of change. The way that voters express that when we talk with them is they're concerned about changing the traditions, values, or institutions of this country that have made the country great over time. Immigrants do bring new ideas, new cultures, different religions, other things. Does it matter particularly if they do change the country?
Well, I think that there's some bedrock values that shouldn't change, and in fact haven't changed. It's the immigrants that change, not the values themselves. The values of our Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the values of free speech, the values of religious tolerance, the values of pluralism, the values of us being a nation of immigrants that can absorb people from every corner of the world, and yet, at the end of the day, because we all pledge allegiance to a flag and a creed, we become one. Those traditions should not change. I think, ironically, that if you look at the values that immigrants bring when they come here, whether they're coming from Poland or Italy or now Vietnam or South Korea or India, the values they bring are quintessentially American values. They're strivers' values. They're the values that say we're going to make something of ourselves, regardless of the station in which we were born. When you look at second-generation immigrants or third-generation immigrants, they are as American as any kid here. And that's been our strength. That's part of what separates us from the United Kingdom or Europe, is we've had that tradition of being a nation of immigrants. And so, when people are concerned about some of the changes that immigrants may bring, they need to go back and read what people were saying about their grandparents or great-grandparents when they came.
We heard from a number of people about immigration when we traveled across the country. One of them was a man named Jose Luis Valdez. Mm-hmm. He's a business owner, a restaurant owner in Kansas City, Kansas. He's a new citizen.
Right.
So he's getting ready to vote for the first time, but he's followed politics for a long time.
Right.
He knows that you won the Latino vote very heavily in both your elections.
What do you think of how he's done it?
I'm really upset. He didn't make anything for us. And my understanding is he do more, deportation.
Yes.
He more deportation than anybody else. And we're really upset about that.
He has said that he has deported more people than many a president.
Than any president, yeah.
And you believe that's correct?
And I believe that's correct, yeah.
So what you've seen is a president who favored immigration reform but didn't get it done when he could have and has actually pushed a lot of people out of the country.
I think he used to us.
Used us is what you just said.
He used our votes.
Yeah.
What would you say to him?
Well, what I'd say to him is his restaurant might not be doing so well if I hadn't focused my first 2 years on saving the economy. So it's not as if I didn't have anything else to do. I think it'd be pretty hard to argue that I haven't put everything I've had into getting this done. But, you know, one of the things that I have learned in this presidency is that until you get something done, people are going to be frustrated. You think of the incredible progress that we've made during the course of my presidency with respect to LGBT rights, the rights of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgender. The historic speed with which we've consolidated equal treatment for that population has been amazing. And, you know, these days, if I go before an LGBT crowd, you know, people are cheering and saying I'm have been one of their greatest champions. But it was only about 3 or 4 years ago when, you know, I'd get heckled in some LGBT events because, you know, marriage equality hadn't gotten done yet, or, you know, before that, don't ask, don't tell hadn't gotten done yet. And it didn't matter how many times I told them, look, you know, it's going to get done. It turns out that the wheels of democracy don't always move as quickly as you'd hope, and I can't just do these things with a stroke of the pen.
Here's what Obama says he has done. He's been able to gain legal status for people brought to the U.S. as children. Courts struck down his broader effort to give legal status to millions more immigrants, but he's telling activists the game is not over.
Right after this most recent Supreme ruling, or lack of ruling, came down, because it was basically a 4-4 tie, I said to them, look, everything's teed up. And instead of despairing, you just need to understand we got 4 months, 5 months, and you've got a very clear choice between two candidates, one of whom not only supports all the initiatives that I put forward, but is going to be in a position, if I don't get a ninth Supreme Court justice, to break that tie. And to one way or another, by next year, we're going to have either my administrative solution to immigration reform done. It will be in train because it will have been decided on and will no longer be blocked. Or alternatively, you know, Mr. Trump will win, in which case you know, we'll have a whole bunch of other problems on our hands with respect to immigration. So in some ways, this is how the democratic process works.
We are playing sound of our talk with President Obama. This is a listening session. We're listening with our political correspondents, Scott Horsley and Mara Liasson. And what stands out for you, Mara?
What stands out for me in that segment was the centrality of globalization as an issue in this election, certainly, and the frustration that the president has about it. Donald Trump has made globalization the villain. He says he has an answer. That's protectionism. And, you know, the benefits of free trade and openness have been described as everyone gets a discount, some people lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. The discount is abstract and diffuse. If you've lost your job or the steel mill is closed in your community, you know that. So I think the challenge for the president and Hillary Clinton is how to offer a solution that's not xenophobic and a solution that's big enough to solve the problem, not just slogans about diversity and openness and inclusiveness.
He talks not about diversity and openness, but about American values in that section.
He has tried to frame this election as an election around values. He's done it over and over again. And I think that's really smart, because Donald Trump represents a certain set of values, and President Obama and Hillary Clinton want to represent another set of values. That's the frame he's putting on this election.
Scott Horsley, let's remember, there are 8 Supreme Court justices right now, 1 vacancy. Republicans won't let the president fill it. Republicans are all about that in the election. In this passage, we hear Obama effectively saying this 9th Supreme Court justice could mean a lot for Democrats.
And it obviously does. I mean, when you look at those two interest groups that he was talking about there, the LGBT community and the Latino community, what very different outcomes we've seen from the Supreme Court handing gays and lesbians a huge victory just over a year ago. I authorizing same-sex marriage in all 50 states, and then this year, on a 4-4 tie, blocking the president's effort to give immigrants in the country illegally a reprieve from deportation. Very big stakes for the Supreme Court.
Okay, let's hear a little more of our talk with President Obama, and let's remember our starting point for this conversation was an NPR News documentary. We traveled across a good part of the country and talked with voters across the country, including one we mentioned to the president.
His name is Kwame Rose. Yeah. He is an activist now in Baltimore. He was active in the protests after the death of Freddie Gray, who was in a police van and died later, as you know. Mm-hmm. And he was unhappy with a statement that you made at the time when you were supportive of peaceful protests, but also criticized what you called criminals and thugs who had looted stores.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think he never experienced, you know, what it was like to be in Baltimore before the uprising. And then I also think, you know, he was speaking from a power of privilege. He wasn't speaking, you know, I didn't grow up like many other people. I didn't grow up like Freddie Gray. I didn't grow up with parents who were on drugs. I had never been in jail for anything serious like he did. But at the same time, I realized that it was somebody that looked like me that was in a situation that could have happened to me just based off of the color of our skin. And I don't think President Obama at that moment looked inside the mirror and saw that there were people who looked like him that weren't as fortunate as he was. And he chastised them.
What would you say to him?
Well, obviously, I don't know him personally, so we'd have to have a longer conversation. What I would say is that the Black Lives Matter movement has been hugely important in getting all of America to see the challenges in the criminal justice system differently. And I could not be prouder of the activism that has been involved. And it's making a difference.
The president talked of a task force that recommended changes in policing after protests in Ferguson, Missouri. Both activists and police were involved.
What I would also say, though, is that if somebody is looting, they're looting. And the notion that they're making a political statement is not always the case, because these are businesses oftentimes owned by African Americans. You have situations in which suddenly friends of mine in Baltimore, their mothers who are elderly, have to now travel across town to get their medicines because the local drugstore got torn up. And making excuses for them, I think, is a mistake.
If I were to summarize what else this young man said, I might say that he feels that he is trying to overturn what he sees as a racist or corrupt system, and that you've become part of it.
Yeah, look, Steve, I think that you can always find folks who are going to feel as if change hasn't happened fast enough. That's the nature of these issues. And by virtue of being president of the United States, if there's a problem out there, then I'm the ultimate public official that people know. And if it hasn't gotten fixed in a couple of weeks, then people are going to say, why didn't you fix it? I think people would be pretty hard-pressed to not see the efforts that we put in around criminal justice reform, where we're supporting it fully. The initiatives that we've made with local mayors and state officials around the country to reform the criminal justice system. The fact that as president, I've been the first ever to even visit a federal prison, that the positions I've taken on criminal justice issues are unprecedented by any president. The work we're doing with commutations is unprecedented, and I've now commuted more sentences for nonviolent drug offenses than the last seven or eight presidents combined. But if you're interviewing a 18 or 20-year-old or 22-year-old kid on the streets of Baltimore who is still feeling frustrated, then you know, I'm not going to be surprised if that frustration is expressed.
That's President Obama speaking in the state dining room of the White House on June 27th. This is a listening session. We're listening with Scott Horsley and Mara Liasson, who are still with us. What stands out to you in that segment?
This is a president who is very much a student of American history and who sees the process of perfecting our union as a process that takes decades or centuries, and that doesn't always square with the timetable of someone who's looking at 2 and 4 year election
He's
cycles.
He's spoken increasingly of passing things on to his successor, teeing up things for other presidents rather than getting things done himself.
Writing your paragraph in the history book, yeah.
Mara?
Yeah, I think when he talks about things are teed up, especially in terms of immigration, you know, he talked about how all we need to do is elect a Democratic president who will pass immigration reform, get that ninth justice on the Supreme Court. You know, I've written my chapter, but now you've got to write chapter two. So he does see himself as part of a process. And certainly in terms of his own legacy, that's not going to be cemented unless he can get Hillary Clinton elected.
A reminder that Republicans do have an opportunity to reverse many of the policies that they dislike so much.
Especially around immigration, because so many of them have been executive orders that can be reversed.
Okay, we're going to continue this listening session after a short break. We've been putting questions to President Obama. We did that after we traveled to 6 states and we talked with voters about their past 8 years. And after this short break, we're going to ask President Obama about his past 8 years. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. It's a listening session. We're listening to a talk with President Obama. We've heard the president talk about Donald Trump.
He's hardly a spokesperson for a legitimate spokesperson for a populist surge from working class people.
We've also heard some stinging remarks about the president.
What do you want to see in the next president?
Someone who actually cares.
She was one of many voters we interviewed for an NPR News documentary. Now, we're going to ask the president about some of his own words. We're going to hear that done in this part of the interview. That part of the conversation included Obama's provocative comments on history, which, as you'll hear, are really comments about now. Now, in this listening session, we're joined by our political correspondents, Mara Liasson and Scott Horsley. How important is history to this president? How much does he think about it?
I think it's very important to him. He talks about it a lot. He talks about Lincoln. He talks about himself standing on the shoulders of civil rights leaders in the past. I think history is really important to this president.
I'm remembering before one of our interviews mentioning an extended biography of Theodore Roosevelt, and he replied, "I've read it." And I believed him. It seemed like this is a guy that's actually diving into the books here.
Yeah, he's a writer, he's an intellectual, and he is a student of history.
Okay, so let's go on in our listening session to hear a little bit more of our talk with President Obama.
As part of this project, we also had a look at your 2008 campaign speech in Philadelphia about race, in which you talked in one passage about anger in the black community, which you said is sometimes counterproductive, but it's real, and there are reasons for it.
Mm-hmm. And to simply wish it away, to condemn it without understanding its roots, only serves to widen the chasm of misunderstanding that exists between the races.
There's another passage which I hadn't even noticed before.
In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They've built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game.
Looking back, were you describing there the same force that is driving much of our election discussion here in 2016?
Well, not only the election discussion driving 2016, this has been an ongoing theme in American history. You can go back and during Jim Crow and segregation, and you've got black sharecroppers who have nothing, and alongside them, poor white farmers who don't have that much more except for the fact that they're white. And the degree to which a lot of politics in the South were specifically designed to make sure that that sharecropper and that white farmer didn't get together to question how the economy was structured and how they both could benefit. I mean, that's one of the oldest stories in American politics. So it's not surprising that what I said in 2008 still holds true today. It was true for a long time.
And a moment later, the president emphasized how much he believes the old divisive politics are still played.
As I travel around the country, what a black working class person has in common with a white working class person is significant. And what prevents them from voting along the same lines or working together on the same projects have to do with the whole range of cultural and identity issues, which, you know, they obviously feel are important and valid. But what I've tried to do throughout my presidency is try to get people to recognize themselves and each other. And that's probably partly related to my own upbringing, right? I was raised by a white mom and white grandparents who, never suffered the kinds of discrimination that their black cohorts might have experienced, but who had their own struggles, who went through a Great Depression, who, a grandmother who had to work her way up without ever a college education, starting in the steno pool or as a secretary to be, and experienced her own discrimination because of being a woman. And so I've seen the degree to which their struggles are not that different from Michelle's parents' struggles, at least in terms of how they think about it, and the similar values of hoping that their kids are going to do better, and that education is the key, and that everybody's got to work hard and take responsibility, but that they'd like a government that was more responsive to clear out some of the barriers for their advancement. And I believe that our politics, when our politics are at our best, is not based on identity politics, but it's based on a sense that everybody should have a fair shot.
Somebody following this year's election might say, well, that debate's worse. It's gotten worse. Do you see any sign that that debate is any better, that it's moved in some direction?
You see it in the younger generation. If you look at the 18 to 30 cohort, or the 18 to 40 cohort, they have a very different set of attitudes about all these issues. It's true, by the way, around the world. We're talking about Brexit. You know, the younger voter wasn't fearful of global interdependence. They embrace it. They see themselves as being able to navigate through all these different worlds. You see it when I visit Vietnam or countries in Africa or Latin America.
And if the president believes young people are comfortable in a connected world, he contends many older people are not.
When you look at the frustrations and the fear that a Trump are tapping into, that's an earlier generation that feels unsettled. And I think we can be sympathetic and understanding of the fact that they feel unsettled, but also recognize that if we get the decisions that need to be made right, then 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we may look back at something like the Trump campaign as the last vestige of a kind of politics of us versus them that really doesn't apply to today.
In our interview with President Obama, we had one more question about Donald Trump. It was also a question about Barack Obama. It involved a statement that the president made early in his first campaign. He was a candidate then, a senator, before a newspaper editorial board, the Reno Gazette Journal.
8 years ago. It wasn't so long ago, but he looks very, very young in the video. And he talks of the possibility of transforming the country. He recalled one president who did.
The 1980 election was different. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan changed the trajectory of America in a way that, you know, Richard Nixon did not, and in a way that Bill Clinton did not. He put us on a fundamentally different path because the country was ready for it. I think they felt like, you know, with all the excesses of the 60s and the 70s, and, you know, government had grown and grown, but there wasn't much sense of accountability in terms of how it was operating. And I think he tapped into what people were already feeling, which is we want clarity, we want optimism, we want, you know, a return to that sense of dynamism and entrepreneurship that had been missing.
That was Obama in 2008. This was our conversation about that statement in 2016. You wanted to see such a moment. You believe there was such a moment for you in 2008. Is there a risk that Donald Trump could say the same thing in 2016, that he could be the man to change the trajectory of the country now?
Well, if he won, he could say that.
I mean to say, you think the country might be ready for that?
No. And I think that'll be tested over the next 4 months. But I think it's pretty hard to argue that somebody who almost three-quarters of the country think is unqualified to be president and has a negative opinion about is tapping into the zeitgeist of the country or is speaking for a broad base of the country. But we'll find out. Look, that's what elections are for. And that I think it's important for Democrats, progressives, moderates, people who care about our traditions, who care about pluralism, who care about tolerance, who care about facts, who think climate change is real, who think that we have to reform our immigration system in an intelligent way, who believe that in women's equality and equality for the LGBT community. I think it's important for those of us not to be complacent, not to be smug. And you know, the one thing I've tried to do during the course of my presidency is to take seriously the objections and the criticisms and the concerns of people who didn't vote for me. I said on election night back in Grant Park, I'm president of everybody. I've got a particular point of view. I don't make any apologies for it. I believe that if you go back and read my speeches dating back to 2004, where I first came to national prominence, that there's been a consistency there, that I have done or tried to do exactly what I said.
That's President Obama talking on June 27th. This is a listening session. We recorded the interview. We brought it back from the White House, as you do, and you play it back to see what you've got. We're playing it with our political correspondents, Scott Horsley and Mara Liasson, who've been listening in our studios. And Scott, that last remark there, saying that he wanted to be the president for everybody. What do you think it means for this president and his legacy that he's proven to be such a polarizing figure?
He has said that's one of his biggest frustrations, his inability to bridge the partisan political divides in this country. Remember, this was a president who burst on the national scene at the Democratic Convention in 2004 with that speech about no red states and blue states, but the United States of America. And it's certainly our country is maybe less united now than it was even in 2004. But I also think, you know, you were asking Mara about history. This is a president who says we cannot ignore our history, but we don't have to be trapped by it. And this is certainly a president who has changed history in important ways. And one of those ways is the racial component in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I think of something that Larry Wilmore said at the correspondence dinner.
The White House correspondence dinner.
The White House
dinner,
correspondence
okay.
dinner this spring when he said, and he's about the same age I am, so this resonated with me. When I was growing up, there were serious conversations in this country about whether a black man had what it took to be the quarterback of a professional football team. Those questions are not going to be asked anymore.
Quite serious comment by a black comedian in that setting. He's really saying something there.
Michelle Obama talked back in the campaign of 2008 about dropping the veil of impossibility from the eyes of minority children all over this country, and that certainly happened. There's also been a change in the way those children's white classmates will look at their classmates growing up because this president's been in office.
You know, we actually heard that in the documentary. We heard that from an African-American superintendent of schools who said that he thought that black and white children would think of black men in a suit differently because they'd grown up seeing Barack Obama, for better or worse, on television.
At the same time, we have also seen a racialization of politics in this country where even issues that didn't used to have a racial component, like, let's say, health care reform, now take on a racial tinge because they're associated with this president.
Which is another thing we heard in our documentary from an African-American voter in Kansas. Mara Liasson, what stands out for you in what you've been hearing?
Well, there's no doubt that President Obama is a historic figure. I totally agree with Scott. The question is he a transformative figure?
Reagan,
he wanted to
way.
Be Ronald yeah. Reagan, not a small ball Bill Clinton yeah. president. Now, we don't know yet. A lot will depend on what happens in the future. And also, our politics is so polarized. I don't know how much of it is Barack Obama. There's an element of that, of course, and race plays a role too. But our politics are so structurally polarized. But we're living in a period of great upheaval. Donald Trump is reordering the DNA of the Republican Party, and we don't know exactly what that means for the future. All of a sudden, you have Republicans in Congress talking about drug use. Why? Because opioids are a big problem in white communities. Mm-hmm. Same thing with criminal justice reform. Same thing with mortality. It's a problem for white working class areas. Same thing with poverty. So everything is being churned up and possibly reordered. So maybe polarization will be changed, too.
He talked about teeing up things for his successor. We'll find out in the years to come whether this, too, a change here, has been teed up in the polarization of the country. Scott Horsley and Mara Liasson, thanks for joining us for this listening session.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be with you.
And stay with us for another moment because we're going to give the president the last word. We had one more question for him in our interview on June 27th.
Last question, Mr. President. We've gone across the country asking people how their lives have changed in the last 8 years. That was the basic question. How has your life changed in the last 8 years?
Well, everybody's teased me about how gray I am, and that's okay. My daughters have
That picture of you and Derek Jeter, that was something. That was some gray. But go on, I'm sorry.
My daughters have grown up, and I think for any father out there, seeing your kids come into office, when I came into office, they were so much younger than I realized at the time, I think. And for them to be these amazing young women now, that changes your life more than just about anything. It's interesting, though, that my fundamental belief in public service, my fundamental belief in the capacity of politics to solve problems, my belief in this country, is stronger, not weaker. I'm less cynical now than I was. I've been frustrated by some things that I did not complete, that I couldn't wrap and mail and ship before I got out of here. Immigration reform being a good example. Getting infrastructure done. You know, we got $2 trillion worth of infrastructure. If we got working on that now, we'd be growing a lot faster. The unemployment rate would be even lower. Wages would be higher. So there are things that we haven't gotten done. Obviously, there are areas internationally where, I've been enormously frustrated. You look at Syria being the most prominent example where you've got a heartbreaking situation and not a lot of good choices.
Having said that, the president began reflecting on some of the jobs he did get done. He said he'd restored ties with Cuba, made a nuclear deal with Iran, and led the United States economy toward recovery.
If you told me that that you could have gay and lesbian men and women proudly serving in our military, without having to hide who they were, or that you could have a bipartisan effort to actually reduce sentences for nonviolent drug offenses, have a credible chance of getting through Congress. You tally it up and you'd say, it's not bad for 7.5 years worth of work.
Mr. President, thanks very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
This has been a special presentation of NPR News. We put questions to President Obama. It was part of a documentary series that also involved interviews with many American voters about the past 8 years. Many thanks to our correspondents, Scott Horsley and Mara Liasson, and our producer, Gabriela Saldivia. I'm Steve Inskeep.